So the Holy Days will be coming up pretty soon. It's amazing. We're here in September, and the feast will be here in the middle of October. And we keep the biblical holy days. They are a fundamental part of our worship of God. And we're blessed to be able to know about them because they reveal to us God's great plan. However, when we came into the church, when we came into the knowledge of the truth, the holy days, for most of us, was something new. For most of us, we didn't know anything about holy days. I didn't know about them. For most of us, we didn't know about the Sabbath. So all of these things were new. I know that as I was sorting out the Sabbath and the holy days, my particular take on them was that they were Jewish. And because they were Jewish, they weren't necessary for us to participate in. That was my unlearned viewpoint. That's how I saw things when I first came into the church. They were Jewish. And how many of you have ever heard anybody, if they know that you keep the Sabbath and holy days, mention that, don't you know those are Jewish? Or, oh, you keep Jewish holy days. Has anybody ever heard that? Yeah, I've heard that. So most of us have. But that's how they look at it. And I remember, one guy was telling me that, we had thrown our unleavened bread into the dumpster of the village where we lived in Illinois. And people had been throwing their trash in there and not paying any trash, paying their trash. They didn't want to pay for trash, so they just dumped it into the village dumpster. Well, they began checking the dumpster and they found our unleavened breads, our bag with the unleavened bread in there. So the guy called me up and said, what are you doing throwing your trash in the dumpster when you're already paying for trash? And I said, well, we keep the days of unleavened bread and we were throwing the unleavened bread in there. What? Excuse me. Sorry about that. We're having a new doctrinal stance made up here, but that's not the case. We're throwing the leavened bread out, so I'm glad that's why she was shaking her head. You're botching it. So anyway, I told him we keep the days of unleavened bread, so we were getting out the leavening. And he said, oh, I've got all kinds of Jewish friends, so okay. So I didn't say any more, and he understood, well, we were doing some sort of a Jewish practice, and he was happy, I was happy, and he didn't hassle me because I was throwing my leavened bread into their dumpster. But that's how we had a limited knowledge of things when we first came into the church, and we didn't fully understand what that was all about. Interestingly, as you look in the scriptures, one of the phrases that we find in there that's a little bit confusing is the phrase, the Feast of the Jews. That particular phrase is found in the book of John. The phrase in exactly those words is used twice by John in his gospel. And John, in describing the ministry of Christ, uses the phrase as a time marker. So it was this particular time. It was close to the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles. So it's helping people understand what time of the year it was. One of the instances talks about the Feast of Tabernacles, and another one of these specific incidences speaks of Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. In addition to these two instances that literally say Feast of the Jews, we have some other usages that sometimes are confusing to people. Let's go to John chapter 7 and look at verse 2. John chapter 7 and look at verse 2. And see, when I saw these, became aware of these phrases, I looked at them from an uninformed, carnal perspective, as I'll explain here in a moment. John chapter 7, verse 2, it says, now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. So the wording is just changed around a little bit, the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles. In John chapter 2, we'll just quickly look at these, so we'll make note of these. John chapter 2, verse 13. John chapter 2, verse 13 says, now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. So at Passover time, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. But he calls it the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles, taking a holy day and labeling it as a day of the Jews. Let's go to John chapter 6, verse 4.
We'll just quickly look at these, so we'll make note of these instances where they appear in the book of John. John chapter 6, verse 4. Now the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. Passover, a feast of the Jews, was near. And the final one is in John chapter 11, verse 55. John chapter 11, verse 55. There it says, "And the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went from the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves." So these are all time markers that John uses, and he refers to them as the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles, or the Jews' Passover, or the Passover of the Jews, or the Feast of Tabernacles of the Jews. So we have six places in the book of John where he takes various holy days and refers to them as Feast of the Jews, or the Jews' Passover, or the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles. And from these scriptures, the Christian world implies that if you observe these days, you are keeping Jewish days. That was my inference. That's what I thought. I believe that when John made these statements, he was making a pejorative statement. You're keeping those feasts of the Jews. Not anti-Semitic, but they are feasts that were commonly kept by the Jews. So is that what John meant? As you'll see, he didn't mean that. We look at this differently. As we look at the holy days that we keep, we don't see them as Jewish days. Now, there are Jews that keep them. That's true. But we don't see them as Jewish days. Instead, we might note that they were days that were given to Israel, weren't they? When they're laid out in the scriptures, they were given to Israel. So they are days that were given to Israel. So we could say that they are Israel's holy days, because they weren't just given to the tribe of Judah. They were given to all 12 tribes, weren't they? But even that is not accurate, because if you look at Leviticus chapter 23, it tells us whose days these days are. They aren't Jewish days. They aren't Israelitish days. They are God's days. They are God's appointed times, God's feast. He says specifically, "These are my feast." And he says that about the Sabbath, and he says it about all the holy days. The fact that they're given to a particular people is irrelevant. And as you come to understand the holy days, you find that, you know what? The holy days apply to all people. They encompass every single person who has ever lived or will ever live. So we live in a world in which we say, "I keep spring, summer, and fall holy days, three seasons. I keep them because they are the feast of God. And out of respect and honor of God, we observe these days." However, we live in a world that sees what we do and says, "You're keeping Jewish feast." And if you haven't heard that, you will. The question that we want to answer today: is John implying in these six places that we are keeping Jewish feast? Is that what John is saying? Would that be an accurate summation? And that's what I used to believe, but once I came to understand the holy days, I saw that I was in error. So what's going on in the book of John? What we want to understand today is what is meant by the Feast of the Jews. Now, as we examine this subject, it's important to note something about John's writing style. And each writer has a particular style. If his style is different, we might ask why. And usually a writer has a difference in style from somebody else, and there's a reason why. We might consider the four Gospels. We have Mark, Luke, and John. All of them refer to the kingdom of God. However, if you go to the book of Matthew, does he use the term the kingdom of God? I think he does, but the overriding phrase that he uses in referring to the kingdom of God is the kingdom of heaven. Now, by using a different terminology, does he have a different theology than Mark, Luke, and John? He doesn't. he's referring to the same thing, just using different wording, and he uses, and there's a reason why he does that. If you look at the term Jews, it is used 85 times in the four Gospels. It is used 5 times in Matthew. The term Jews is used in Mark only 6 times and in Luke 5 times. And interestingly, as you look at the book of John, John uses the term Jews 69 times. 69 times. Now, the question is, why does John use a different vocabulary than Matthew, Mark, and Luke? And it would seem obvious that the term Jews would be significant in John's writing due to its frequency of use. He uses it 69 times, and the other writers of the Gospels don't use it anywhere near as many times. So why is that? And just by noting what we've noted, it doesn't answer the question of why did he use it so many times. Another consideration is this. Which of the four Gospels is focused on the Jews? Jewish life, Jewish teachings, Jewish history, everything Jewish. It's the book of Matthew. It is the book of Matthew. And, since that book is written with the Jews in mind, it would seem to make sense that he would use the term Jews more often. But in fact, he doesn't. He doesn't use it more often. John is the one who uses it frequently. Since we have a string of 6 places where John referred to various of the annual holy days as the Feast of the Jews, I would like to turn to John chapter 10 and look at what it says there, because John 10 helps to pose a question for us and helps gives us an interesting perspective. And what we find in John chapter 10 is that John uses not only the Feast of the Jews, but he also uses a Jewish national holy day as a time marker. Let's look at John chapter 10, verse 22. John chapter 10, verse 22. It says, "Now it was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter." Now, most of us don't refer to this particular feast as the Feast of Dedication. We would refer to it as maybe the Feast of Lights, or we would refer to it as Hanukkah. But the Feast of Dedication, Hanukkah, and the Feast of Lights, they're all the same thing. And this particular national celebration originated back in the times of the Maccabees after they had defeated the Seleucids and they had begun to offer sacrifices in the temple, and it relates to the oil that was almost gone, and the oil, they lit the lamp in it, and it lasted for a particular amount of time, and which was a miracle in and of itself. So they celebrated this particular day. John chapter 2, verse 10, verse 22, we've looked at the name of it. It says in verse 23, "And Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. Then the Jews surrounded him and said to him, 'How long do you keep us in doubt? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly.'" So it's interesting, as you look at this, it's called the Feast of Dedication. It's not called the Jews' Feast of Dedication. It's not called the Feast of Dedication a Feast of the Jews. This is a clearly Jewish observance, national observance, but the term Jews is not used there. It is not used there. And the question is, why, if you refer to the annual feast of God as Feast of the Jews, don't you use the same wording with the Feast of Dedication? Why is that? Well, the reason is, the Feast of Dedication is a Jewish feast, and when you look at the nation of Israel, it was long gone. It had been a long time since they had gone into captivity. The Jews had returned from Babylon, and Israel is gone. But John doesn't use that term here, and the reason is because you could keep the Feast of Dedication anywhere in the world. You could keep the Feast of Dedication anywhere in the world. You see, where were you to keep the feast up until the fall, the destruction of the temple? There was only one place in the world, and that was in Jerusalem. All right? But you could keep a national holiday like the Feast of Dedication anywhere. There was no requirement to come up to the temple. But when you're looking at the holy days, there was a requirement. So let's look at John chapter 7, verse 1. Let's go to John chapter 7 and look at verse 1. So we're going to examine different sides of this. John chapter 7 and John 7, beginning in verse 1, presents a little bit different perspective. This is the verse preceding the verse that said the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. Now the question is, how does this particular verse read in the King James Version? Because it's different than the way it reads in the New King James. It says in John chapter 7 verse 1 in the King James Version, it says, "After these things Jesus walked in Galilee, for he would not walk in Jewry, because the Jews sought to kill him." So he would not walk in Jewry. Now, when I first read that back 40 years ago or so, I thought that that was, again, a pejorative term, a negative term. It was being used negatively. But it's not being used negatively at all. When you look at the New King James Version, it helps answer the question, what's he referring to when he's talking about Jewry? It makes it pretty clear. John chapter 7, verse 1 in the New King James Version says, "After these things Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea, because the Jews sought to kill him." So the use of the term Jewry, which the translators of the New King James Version understood to imply in the Greek the province of Judea, he used it, that he expressed it that way, and it's translated as Judea in the New King James Version. The question we have to ask is, the Jews sought to kill him if he entered into the territory of Judea, but if you think about Galilee, there weren't any Jews living there? In fact, there were. So what's the answer to this? What's he afraid of? Why weren't the Jews in Galilee trying to kill him? So you have Jews on either side of the border. One side of it's called Judea, the other side is called Galilee. And people on both sides of the border were Jews. Talking about geography. Galilee was a province in the territory there, and was ruled by a different ruler. And you had Judea, which was a province in the Roman area there, and it was ruled by somebody different than the ruler of Galilee. One reality of geography we find in the scriptures is that Judea, the people of Judea, felt themselves superior to the Hicks and the Bumpkins that were in Galilee. Right, they thought those people are primitives by comparison with those of us who live in Judea. And so let's go to John chapter 146. John chapter 1 verse 46. And this is a common thing among human beings. You know, I live in a part of town that's better than yours. You know, we hear the term, I live across the tracks. And that was always considered, whatever that meant, to be an inferior area. And John chapter 1, verse 46, it says, "And Nathanael said to him, 'Can anything good come out of Nazareth?' Philip said to him, 'Come and see.'" So, obviously, Nathanael had a certain prejudice against people from Galilee. So when he heard this man that was preaching, that was being recommended to him, "Are you kidding me? Can anything good come out of Galilee?" So he went to find out. And as I said, the people of Galilee were seen as Hicks and Bumpkins. They had a little bit different
language, because you know that, because Peter, when he was talking to the maid there that served the high priest, the way he spoke, she could tell he wasn't from Judea. You're not from here. You're following the Galilean. And his speech was Galilean in the way that it sounded. She could tell that he wasn't a native of Judea. Interestingly, it's very common that you have one area of feeling it's superior to others. When we moved to Ohio, we were looking for a place to live. And there were two counties that butted up against each other. There was Ross County, and there was Pike County. So the people in Ross County said, you don't want to be moving to Pike County. Basically, they're hicks and bumpkins down there, and primitive, you don't want to live in Pike County. So guess where we ended up? Pike County. So anyway, we chose to live there because the price was right, and it actually worked out quite good for us in the long run. But people told us just straight out, no, you don't want to live in Pike County. That's a primitive place. But it was a very nice place actually to live during the 20 years we spent there. And one area feeling superior to the others, you know, it's like if you're in Canada, who do you make fun of? You make fun of the newfies. So it seems like every part of the world or every state, you have, you know, I think people to a degree pick on Aggies here, and you got Aggie jokes and that kind of thing. And that's just the way it is. So that's how we are as human beings. There's only one other time where a gospel writer uses the term Jewry. Let's go there now in Luke chapter 23. And Luke gives us a little bit more understanding. Luke chapter 23, and let's begin in verse 1. Luke chapter 23, verse 1. It says, then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. So this is the section of the Gospels that speaks about Christ's arrest and it's setting things up for his execution. So they led him to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, we found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ a king. Then Pilate asked him, saying, are you the king of the Jews? And so, are you the king of the Jews? And he answered and said, and said, it is as you say. So Pilate said to the chief priest and the crowd, I find no fault in this man. But they were more fierce, saying, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea. And if you have a King James version of the Bible, it says Jewry, throughout all Jewry, beginning from Galilee to this place. So Galilee is a different area, a different province than that of Judea. And they're saying that he is teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee. So he's preaching his message in Galilee, and now he's entered into Judea and is sharing that message with other people, and this is a problem. In verse 6, it says, when Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if the man were a Galilean. And Pilate, who really didn't want to deal with him, and was trying to pass him off, said, hey, he's from Galilee. Let's send him to the ruler of Galilee and let him make the decision, and then it's off my plate. I don't have to deal with it. But unfortunately, the ruler of Galilee was not able to come to a decision, and he sent Christ back to Pilate. So again, there's a simple understanding. Where does Jewry begin? Well, Jewry begins where Galilee ends. So you leave Galilee and you enter Jewry or Judea. That's what he's talking about. Luke is the only other writer that uses this term. It's used once by John and used once by Luke. And this is a significant point because Galilee was also a land with a Jewish population. But as I said, the Jews of Judea saw themselves as superior. They saw themselves as different. And John designates Jewry as a distinct geographical area. It's how he describes the province of Judea. So we've seen a couple of areas where we see John's style. And in John's style, we might ask, who are the Jews?
in his way of writing the book, who are the Jews? Now you may say, well, that's obvious. There are people that live in Judea. They live in Galilee. Well, who are the Jews? Let's see if we can learn what John is getting across here. Let's go to John chapter 1 and look at verse 19. John chapter 1, verse 19. It says, now this is the testimony of John when the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, who are you? Verse 20, he confessed and did not deny, but confessed, I am not the Christ. And they asked him, what then, are you Elijah? He said, I am not. Are you the prophet? And he answered, no. Then they said to him, who are you, that we may give an answer to those who sent us? What do you say about yourself? So the Jews sent people to inquire of John who he was. Who are you? And as you look at who these people are, it says that they were priests and Levites from Jerusalem. Well, if you stop and think about that for a second, weren't the priests and Levites Jews? I mean, isn't that right? They're all Jews. Everybody involved in the story here are Jews. So who are the Jews? And obviously, whoever the Jews are, these priests and Levites are answerable to them. As you think about the world of Judea, it was not a democracy. The common Jew could neither read nor write. And in terms of the religious community, the common Jew was looked down upon. So there were Jews that felt themselves superior to the common Jew. And from their perspective, they didn't want to get too close to them because then they would be ceremonially defiled. So the priests and the Levites that are being referred to here, they came up from Jerusalem, came down from Jerusalem, which is the headquarters of the Jews. Whoever the Jews are, Jerusalem is the headquarters. And the Levites and priests could have been Pharisees by their political and religious persuasion, but by their ethnicity, they could have been Sadducees, for instance, if they were related to Aaron. Descended from Aaron, then they might have been priests, and they might have been, therefore, Sadducees. In John's style of writing, the Jews he's speaking of here is the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin, a body controlled by the Pharisees, but composed of Pharisees, priests, and Levites. And as you look at the statement, all of these things are true, but for a person who's not aware of what's going on, it could possibly be confusing. And we'll get to his audience here in a little while. And they probably wouldn't have understood what he's talking about. Who are these people? They're all Jews, aren't they? Why are we distinguishing between the Jews, who would be priests and who could be priests and Levites? Why are we making that distinction? And John is making that distinction for a reason. So the Sanhedrin in Roman times was given the right and privilege to oversee religious matters. But the Romans controlled civil matters. They chose to control the civil matters, the Sanhedrin, and the priests and Levites. They all controlled the religious matters. Since you had a great religious person appearing on the scene here in John chapter 9, in what we see here in John chapter 1, they want to know who this guy was. Who is this guy who's preaching and causing such a stir? They wanted to know, and they sent some of the people that served them out to find out, and they were to bring back to them who this person was. So let's go to John chapter 19. And again, we go back to the trial of Jesus Christ. We go back to the trial of Jesus Christ. So in John 19, we find that Pilate has interrogated and investigated the matter of Jesus. And he's not found justification for condemning him. So he keeps trying to
let him go.
He's trying to let him go. But let's see what it says here in John chapter 19 in verse 12. From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." So who cried out? The Jews. But I would imagine that everybody that was there when they cried out, they were all Jewish. And there were people that cried out, but not everybody that was there cried out. Probably the majority of the people that were there, they were just observing. They were just observing what's going on. It's like human beings. Human beings, when they see something unfold, oh, there's a crowd gathering, you know what human beings do? Let's check this out. So you go over and you check it out. Now, you may not participate, but you're over there watching what's going on, and you're hopefully staying back far enough in case things get out of hand and the Roman soldiers start cutting everybody down that you can get out of the area. I know this from personal experience when I was in college. It all went wrong, and some people were too close to the chaos when it unfolded. John chapter 19, verse 6. John chapter 19, verse 6. It says, "Therefore, when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out." So here we have, who are the Jews? The chief priests and officers saw him. They cried out, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." Verse 7, it says, "The Jews answered him." So who are the Jews? It's been defined by verse 6. They are the priest and the officer, the chief priest and officers. "The Jews answered him, 'We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God.'" So we understand who the Jews are here. And it says that they mentioned that they have a law. Well, we might ask, who are the interpreters of the law? Who are the people conversant with the law? They are the priest and the religious leaders of the Jews. They're the ones who are conversant in the law. And those are the people in verse 6, the chief priests and officers of the temple. They were the ones who knew about the law and interpreted the law. Let's go down to verses 15 and 16 of John 19. "But they cried out, 'Away with him, away with him, crucify him.' Pilate said to them, 'Shall I crucify your king?' The chief priest answered, 'We have no king but Caesar.' Then he delivered him to them to be crucified. So they took Jesus and led him away." So as we look at this, who are the Jews? Who are the Jews? They are the same general Jewish body sent to inquire about John the Baptist. Who are you? By what authority are you doing what you're doing, preaching and baptizing? The Jews are revealed to be, in John 19, the Jewish religious leadership. Now, let's look at one other thing that's interesting here. They're called the Jews, and so when you see that term, the Jews, you got to look at it in the context. Is it talking about the religious leadership, or is it a general name for all Jews? Who is exactly being talked about there? Let's go to John chapter 7, verse 1. John chapter 7. And what we see in John chapter 7 is the common human tendency for one group to look down on another. And we find this in John chapter 7. We've looked at verse 1. It says, "After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him." They sought to kill him. Let's go down to verse 10. It says, "But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, 'Where is he?
So is this the general population of Jews? There were probably 1 million people in the city at this time. So is that who it's talking about? Or is it talking about this smaller, select group of religious leaders who were seeking him? So, and there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said he is good. Others said, no, on the contrary, he deceives the people. So you had people looked at him differently. Some of them sought to kill him. And we also find here in verse 13, however, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. So these are Jews afraid of other Jews. Okay, so that's the religious leadership that they were afraid of. And they knew if we get involved with this man, they are already against him. Maybe we just want to stay out of that. So most people, they said he's a good man. Other people said he's not so good. It was a mixed bag of opinion. But they were also afraid of the Jews who would punish them if they were involved with them. Verse 14. Now about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and taught. And notice this. It says, And the Jews marveled, saying, how does this man know letters, having never studied? So these people had been educated in the scriptures at elite schools. All right? And they all knew the elite schools. They knew the graduates of those schools. And here's this guy expounding the scriptures, knowing the scriptures, and they're saying, where did this guy study? What school did he go to? Where's his diploma? You know, did he just go to a junior college? Where did he get his information from? How can he speak with such eloquence about the scriptures? And so they're judging him as being inferior. He probably went to some second-rate school and learned these things. He didn't go to our elite schools, and he's inferior to us. So they're definitely judging Christ, and that's how we tend to do. Where did you go to school? And if somebody asks you that, most likely they're going to judge you based on what school you went to. Oh, I went to Sam Houston State. I went to Baylor, or I went to wherever, University of Texas, and people look down on other people because of where they went to school, or I just went to the local community college. Again, that's the way human beings are. Verse 20, it says, the people answered and said, you have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you? Who's seeking to kill you? The people answered and said, you have a demon. So again, is this the people in general who are seeking to kill him? Or the religious leadership? So as you look at that and you've seen the other things taking place in chapter 19, you have to conclude that when it talks about the people in this particular scripture, it's talking about the Jews, the religious leadership. It's not talking about Jews in general, because they really weren't involved with Christ and weren't worried about Christ. Verse 31 says, and many of the people believed in him and said, when the Christ comes, will he do more signs than these, which this man does? Many of the people. And this is the general population. This is not the religious leadership that it's talking about there. And then let's go to chapter 19, verse 44. It says, now some of them wanted to take him, but no one laid hands on him. Then the officers came to the chief priests and Pharisees, who said to them, why have you not brought him? And the officers answered, no man ever spoke like this man. Then the Pharisees answered them, are you also deceived? And so they're wanting him to be arrested. And they said, have any of the rulers of the Pharisees believed in him? The Pharisees set the standard. Do they believe in Christ? But this crowd that does not know the law is accursed. Again, they're looking down on the general population. The officers, the chief priests, and Pharisees are all part of the Sanhedrin. And here is an educated leadership who look down their noses at Christ
and the general population. So in John's vocabulary, he makes a distinction between the Jews, referring to the religious leadership, and when he speaks of the general population of the Jews, he refers to them as the people. However, when he uses the term the people, as we saw in verse 20, he's referring to the religious leadership, the Jews. So we have in John's writing a contrast between people who are neutral. Christ can preach and some are impressed while others are not. And we have a leadership that is completely opposed to him. Completely opposed to him and wants to kill him, and eventually they do so. So we find that John uses the term Jew 69 times in his gospel. And that particular term most often refers to the religious leadership. You have to look at what's being said and look at the context. Now let's go back to the original question with what we've looked at so far. Let's think about this. Why does he call the holy days Feast of the Jews? We've seen that John in his vocabulary singled out the province of Judea from all the rest of the Jewish world to assign to it the label Jewry, or as we would say in more modern language, Judea. So if you go to the day of Pentecost when the church began, and you read the listing of locations that Jews had come to be in Jerusalem on Pentecost, they came from all over the world, all over the Roman Empire. And they were all Jews. They were all Jews. But John chooses to refer only to those who live inside the boundaries of Judea as Jewry. And John, in a number of instances, distinguishes between the leaders of the land and the ordinary people of the land, and by referring to the leaders as the Jews, and the general population as the people, the crowd, the multitude. John called the holy days Feast of the Jews, but he didn't call the Feast of Dedication the Feast of the Jews. It was a Feast of the Jews, but why did he make that distinction? Why did he make that distinction? As I said, the Feast of Dedication is not a holy day. It is a national celebration, and you can celebrate it anywhere. You weren't required to be at the temple for that celebration. But when you kept Pentecost or any of the other holy days, the focal point was the temple. It was Jerusalem. Now, did you have to come up to Jerusalem? No. But ideally, you would be there for the feast, if you could make it. So let's go back to an earlier point here. The only instance where the term Jewry is used outside the book of John was Luke. All right, we looked at that. We read that. And by deduction, this makes perfect sense, since we would find the use of the term Jewry in John and Luke. Interestingly, as you look at Luke, Luke is the most Gentile. He is a Gentile author, and he's writing for Gentiles. His audience is Gentile, and they're not familiar with Jewish history or anything about the Jews. That's not something that's common to them. And so Luke, to make his point, speaks of Jewry because it's going to help his audience understand that particular time marker. John, who is probably as Jewish as any of the apostles, we still have a question of why John uses the word Jew and Jews so often in his gospel. The climax of the whole issue comes down to this. Where was John writing from? Where was John writing from? It is thought, John's headquarters at the end of his life was in Ephesus. Now, was Ephesus a Jewish city or a Gentile city? It actually was a Gentile city. And the people living there were not familiar with Judea. They weren't familiar with Jewish customs and Jewish life. They may have known of Jews because some of them lived in their community, but they did not understand the bigger picture. They didn't understand that. And really, as you think about it, in writing his gospel, John is not in Judea. nor in a nearby province like Syria or Egypt. I mean, had a sizable Jewish population in Egypt and a sizable Jewish population in Syria. He's in Asia Minor in a time when people didn't travel much. They wouldn't know about the Jews or Jerusalem or the temple or how things worked. So Luke's audience needed an explanation, and so did John's. And it goes further than that. Although there is a debate about whether John wrote the book, he did, we believe, and the dating of the book, I mean, there's an opinion that the book was written over 150 years, and we don't believe that. We know that the book of Revelation was written at the end of his ministry. He was on the island of Patmos at that time. We also know that John wrote three letters that were written late, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. And there's also every reason to believe that John's gospel was also written late, in the 90s A.D. So if he's writing in the 90s A.D., where's the temple? He's writing in the 90s A.D., where's the temple? The temple's gone. The temple was destroyed by the Romans in 70 A.D. There is no temple. There are no sacrifices. There is no priesthood. That's all gone. So here you have people living 20 years or so after the demise of the temple. How in the world are they going to know anything about that? Unless somebody tells them. And that's what John was doing in the way that he wrote the book. So they weren't familiar. You know, people would go up to the feast to be there at Passover or Pentecost or the Feast of Unleavened Bread. They were pilgrimage festivals. There were no pilgrimage festivals by the time John is writing his book. So he's pointing out to them what used to take place in the city of Jerusalem. So we sit here, as we think about this, one way that maybe we can understand it is this. Mr. Herbert Armstrong died in 1986. All right? And for those of you who have been around a while, you have heard of Mr. Herbert Armstrong. You know who he was. But if you are 30 years of age, you probably don't know who he was. You have little or no experience with him. It's doubtful anyone below the age of 40 would have any reason to have any memory of him at all. Now, if you go back to Mr. Armstrong's writings and you look at some of the original writings that come from the 30s and the 40s and 50s and 60s, do any of you remember something that stood out about the writing? How about all the full caps? How about the bolding, the exclamation points? Now, we all think, what in the world was that all about? But see, we're looking at it from a more modern perspective. If you went back to the 1920s when Herbert Armstrong was trained, he was trained in advertising. And if you go back to ads from that period of time, those ads will look exactly like the publications of the church. Because that was what was felt was going to be most effective in reaching people. But you have to go back and look at that to understand, okay, that's the way it used to be. Mr. Armstrong was trained that way, and that's why he did what he did. But you have to go back and get some context. So what John is doing as he uses this terminology, Jew, and various forms of that, he's trying to make a point to them to help them to understand the context of the whole thing. Because they were living in Ephesus and they did not understand that picture. John wrote about the Feast of the Jews and the Jews and Jewry all as ways of telling people who are both geographically separated from the region and chronologically separated from the time. He's helping them to understand things about that time. So they can more fully grasp Christ, his sacrifice, and what it all meant. So now you have the information to explain why John referred to God's feast as the Feast of the Jews. I hope that
is something that you can understand, and hopefully it will arm you. So if somebody brings that up as a reason why we don't need to keep the peace, you can say, let me take an hour and I'll explain it to you. Probably just take the summary and give them the short bit of input.